hate your mother. No, I'm not quoting a death metal song. I'm quoting Jesus about what his love demands on you and one of the most shocking things he ever said. He probably didn't say it in the same tone, but you get the point. Love is free, but here's the catch. It costs you everything, especially God's love. This is from Luke 14. Large crowds were traveling with Jesus, and turning to them, he said, "If anyone comes after me and does not hate his father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, yes, even their own life, such a person cannot be my disciple. And whoever does not carry the cross and follow me cannot be my disciple." And he also said, "Those of you who do not give up everything you have cannot be my disciples." Look, of course, the guy who said, "Love your enemy and encourage keeping commandments," which includes honor your father and mother, wasn't being literal about hating your mom. He was speaking emphatically and hyperbolically to make a point, which he often did. But the point he was making was no less shocking than those literal words themselves. And it's this. It's that our love of him and loyalty to him has to be so much higher than any other bond in our lives, including the most fundamental bonds that tie us to our mothers and children, those most gut-level bonds, that our relationships with those people might as well be called hate in comparison to our love of God. That's how much higher and greater our love and loyalty toward him has to be. Whew. And guys, that's not just a reflection of Jesus about how to follow him and a nice thought about how to live our lives. This is actually one of the most disturbing, direct, central claims that Jesus made about his own divinity. Right? And to be clear to my little Arian friends out there, we don't believe in Jesus and God. And I really hate when people say that. Look, Jesus is God. He is divine. He is the second person of the Trinity. Jesus Christ is God the Son. Three persons, one God. All right, so when you hear those words today, you really simply can't do what so many people like to do today, which is demote Jesus to the level of a prophet or a wise man. Oh, Jesus, he was a very good person, a great role model, a revolutionary, an influential man. Let's even call him a prophet. No. None of that works. Guys, if one thing sets Jesus' teachings apart from every other religious figure in history or every other philosophical leader, it was that all roads in his teachings led to him. Think about it. Buddha didn't do that. Buddha pointed to a path toward enlightenment. Muhammad pointed to Allah. Jesus pointed to himself. Instead of telling people how to go and get forgiveness, he made it clear that he is the source and font of forgiveness. He said wild things to people who he'd never met before, people who clearly didn't wrong him in any personal way on a human level. He'd walk right up to them and say, "Your sins are forgiven you," which rightly caused an uproar among the people listening who didn't yet know or believe in his divinity. How can he forgive someone their sins? Instead of telling people they had to follow a particular way of life, he said the radical words, "I am the way." And there's so much more, guys. But the gospel reading today, it's the clincher. Love me more than anyone, even your mom. Guys, Jesus was either divine, he was either God, the second person of the Blessed Trinity, or he was a narcissist. Not just a wise man, not just a prophet. It was one or the other, God or crazy. Hard stop. That was a beautiful case that C.S. Lewis made. Lord, liar, or lunatic. And this is why maybe Jesus makes people who aren't sold on his divinity so uncomfortable. It's because his claims should make you kind of uncomfortable if you don't believe them. Look, Jesus' claims about himself and what he was owed because of who he is as divine, they're shocking. The one thing those claims don't allow, if we take those demands at face value to absolute loyalty, is indifference. Yeah, he was just a nice guy. Nope, doesn't work. In his book, Jesus Shock, Peter Kreef talked about how you can talk about anything else around the water cooler at work, but the moment you say the name Jesus, it falls like a big rock into the midst of the conversation. Silence. It introduces awkwardness because that name demands something of us. That we either recognize he is who he said he was or reject him. And for you nerds out there, Kreeft also referenced this beautiful image from The Lord of the Rings where the hobbits are joyfully shocked to encounter Gandalf after he comes back from the dead. And many say that's like the apostles encountering Jesus risen from the dead. No, not even close. What happened when the apostles met Jesus would be more like the hobbits meeting J.R.R. Tolkien than Gandalf risen. Tolkien breaking through the cover and diving into the pages with them. If Jesus is who he said he was, then his words are true. Then we owe him our allegiance before any other relationship or any other priority in our lives. Not the allegiance Sam would owe to Frodo or Gandalf. The allegiance Sam and Frodo and Gandalf would all owe the author, Tolkien, if he stepped into the story. Whew, total game changer. And he is who he said he was. Now, please allow me to make you who profess to believe in Jesus' divinity uncomfortable for a minute as I apply this principle to your life in some challenging ways. Guys, if he is who he said he was, this means that if you have dreams of your kid being kind of next level successful, and those dreams are attached to a scholarship at a great college, but there's no campus ministry there, and it's a pagan atmosphere, and that atmosphere is likely to destroy your kid's faith, and you know that risk. Guys, you got to make a choice. Jesus or prestige and money? Guys, Jesus comes first. Find a different college. I can't tell you the number of parents I've talked to whose children have lost their faith because priority number one was how prestigious that college X was over there, over Steubenville, just to name my alma mater as one, or one of many other great Catholic colleges, but they made their choice. And I have compassion, and I don't want to blame the parent because the kid has free will, but I kind of want to say sometimes, what did you think would happen? And were you willing to take that risk? Because gosh darn it, it's what panned out. Because the demands of Jesus mean that if you have a relationship and you're dating this beautiful girl who wants to sleep with you outside of marriage, and gosh, she really is really pretty, and there's some potential in the relationship that might make you really happy on an earthly, fleshy level, will you dump her or will you dump Jesus? Because sometimes you don't get both. To paraphrase Jesus in the gospel today, if you don't hate the things in the world that lead you away from me, hate meaning reject, not a visceral, violent hatred, but push them away from you, then you're not worthy of me. Guys, Jesus being number one, being who he claimed to be, means that you need to be willing to talk and hold yourself in a way that's going to distance you from some family and friends. Are you going to be the new you anyway? Or are you going to act like your old self around them to make them comfortable? If you got a career that's making you go to bed at night with a troubled conscience, well, what do you pick, guys? Jesus or that great money, those golden handcuffs? Listen, you don't always get to pick both. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, the famous German Lutheran pastor who was martyred because he stood against the Nazis, he wrote one of the best rants I've ever read about a Christianity with no demands. And he calls it cheap grace. Cheap grace, he said, is the preaching of forgiveness without requiring repentance, baptism without church discipline, communion without confession, absolution without personal confession. Cheap grace is grace without discipleship, grace without the cross, grace without Jesus Christ, living and incarnate. Costly grace is the hidden treasure in the field. For the sake of it, a man will gladly go and sell all that he has. Such grace is costly because it calls us to follow. It's grace because it calls us to follow Jesus Christ. It's costly because it costs a man his life, and it's grace because it gives a man the only true life. It's costly because it condemns sin, and it's grace because it justifies the sinner. Above all, it's costly because it costs God the life of his son. You were bought at a price. And listen to this. What has cost God much cannot be cheap for us. Above all, it's grace because God did not reckon his son too dear a price to pay for our life, but delivered him up for us. Costly grace is the incarnation of God. Whew, man, gives me chills reading that because I know that Bonhoeffer lived those words, knew the absolute allegiance he owed to Jesus Christ, which trumped the allegiance that he owed to his local government as it became Nazi, and he paid the ultimate price following the Lord who paid the ultimate price for him. Guys, in our own ways, it's what God wants of us. The love God offers you is free, but look, if you want it, it's going to cost you everything. And why? Because it costs him everything. And that's how love works. When I offered my wife my life and presented a ring to her, I was going to say, will you marry me? But I said, that's really literally how it happened. And she said, yes, thank God. 6 kids later, I'm talking to you right now. But look, guys, what I didn't want in response to the gift I was offering her of my life was a bargain, was a part of her heart, was an hour a week and some of her allegiance. No, I was giving her my all. I wanted her all. And that is the only way to understand the Christian path, Christian morals, Christian asceticism. Christian life isn't a cold, stoic, tired out thing. It's the fire of love. That's the heart of Christian morality and asceticism and everything you might ever sacrifice for your faith. It's not because some ideal comes first. It's because Jesus comes first above everything else. To look to someone else who, like Bonhoeffer, but in her own way, sacrificed everything for Jesus. A hero of mine, St. Clare of Assisi. I love thinking of this beautiful, young, wealthy woman just being smitten and falling in love with Jesus as she heard the message of St. Francis and falling in love with the life of St. Francis, the way he followed Jesus so much that she entered monastic life. I love thinking of this woman who had everything and all her worldly beauty kneeling on the cold, hard floor of the chapel of Mary of the Angels in Assisi, which Francis had rebuilt by hand. And there she traded her beautiful dress for a sackcloth. And St. Francis himself cut the golden locks from her head as she took vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience. Clare went from riches to rags. Guys, her family thought she had lost her mind and they came to drag her off, literally. She grabbed onto the altar and she wouldn't let go. Her father gave up the tug of war between him and God when Clare took off her veil and showed him her freshly chopped head of hair. Her dad just left stunned. I could sympathize with the dad. Look, he wanted to give his daughter everything, but she left the, quote, everything of this world for something more. What is that something more? Clare wrote that we should, quote, love him totally, who gave himself totally for your love. What's that look like for you guys? Whether you're a teenager leaving the wrong crowd or a young woman leaving the world to join a convent, Christian sacrifice and asceticism and moral life, it's not about detaching from something, but detaching for something, or rather to someone. By the way, quick tangent, I'm really excited about this. I'm leading a retreat to Assisi for the 800th anniversary of Francis's death next October. It's going to be a pilgrimage unlike any other. Link below in the show notes. Come with me. But when I asked my bride to marry me, I wasn't only turning my back on the world, on the endless possibilities of other women, nights out with the guys, freedom to do whatever I wanted. I was turning my back toward the love before me. Guys, what's standing between you and a deeper walk with God? Is it a major sin? Or maybe more insidiously, it's just some stupid minor comfort that's holding you back from becoming a great saint. The courage behind every next step from you today to saint, insert your name here, comes from remembering the love before you is better than the life behind you. You got to ruthlessly eliminate from your life, as if you hated it, anything and anyone standing between you and the will of God. Anything. Guys, I would do anything for my wife, but my first allegiance is with Jesus. I would not sin for my wife. And here's the beautiful irony of it all, guys. It's the strange promise given to those who put God first. As C.S. Lewis said, when we put first things first, we get second things thrown in. But if we put second things first, we lose both first and second things. Did you follow that? Guys, nothing gives you back all the loves of your life, only better, except this: putting God's love in front of all of them in first place. Look, I'd do anything for my wife, but I love God more. Natalie's told me many times that I'm second place for her. I love you, Chris, but I love Jesus more than you. Ironically, I feel the same way about her, and that's why we have a happy marriage. During the years of marriage where everything felt so painful and confusing and dysfunctional, do you think it was my love and warm fuzzies for my wife that kept us married or kept me loving her or her loving me? No. Guys, there are times in our marriage where only our love for Jesus kept us willing to love each other. Stay married long enough, you'll go through those times too. And guys, we lasted through those times. We fought through those times, literally. And we have a great marriage today because Jesus comes before her. And that's true in every relationship in our lives. But guys, this principle applies to everything. The person who's putting their career first, even before God, you think they're really free to enjoy it or take risks to grow it? No, they'll be terrified about holding on to it. The person who puts their friends first, even before their relationship with Jesus, you think they're really enjoying those friendships? You think they're actually healthy friendships where people are leading one another to the good, to heaven? No. Look, when I see a teenage kid tying their identity to their group of friends, they'll do anything. They'll do anything for that group of friends. They'll even sacrifice their own sense of worth and their own identity to hold on to those friendships. So they put the friends first. They lose real friendship in the process. Or think about a parent who's really clingy to their children and says, my child is everything to me. No, guys, I love my kids. My kids are not everything to me. God is everything to me. But if a parent starts to make children God, children and their happiness and their success the idol, you think they actually enjoy the relationship they have with that child? No, it becomes a codependent mess. And side point, guys, it's only a parent who loves God more than that kid's comfort, who knows how to raise that kid right, how to place limits on a kid who's being rebellious for a while, which will eventually produce a better kid, thanks be to God. But you got to tough it out through those times when your kid's saying, I don't want to go to church. Well, too bad. I don't want to stop dating that guy that you don't trust. Too bad. I hate you, Dad. That's fine. Cool. I'm doing what's right before God as a father, and your five other siblings really like me a lot. So one out of six isn't that bad, and you'll come around. Discipleship costs everything. But when you put God first, everything is what he wants to give back to you. Healthy relationships where you don't confuse people with God. A clean conscience. The joy of holiness. Hopefully, good kids, but that's up to them too. And if I can add to the list, guys, research has proven that holy people are actually more likely to describe themselves as, quote, very happy. They have healthier habits. They do more good in the world. They have happier marriages and are less likely to get divorced. They even live, on average, 4 years longer than people who don't go to church or have God as an active part of their lives. We'll link to all that cool research below. And none of that's prosperity gospel, guys. It's just cause and effect. People living good lives, rightly ordered under one God as their first allegiance, their first love, are just more likely to end up experiencing the fruit of a life well lived. But even when you don't, you can get the real success of having God, a clean conscience, and a purpose-filled life of real joy. What else matters? Guys, as the one who said, take up your cross and follow me promised, whoever wants to save their life will lose it. But whoever loses their life for me will find it. Keep God first place. God bless you.